Welcome to The Buzz. I'm Christopher Conover. This week, a look at the results of Tuesday's election. While Arizonans tend to focus on the results of elections that will fall in even-numbered years when state and federal offices are up for grabs, off-year elections can bring some notable decisions. This year saw the usual Tucson city elections, changes to city charters around the state, plus a number of decisions about school bonds and overrides. Also, there was a vote for an unincorporated community to form a government. We'll dive into the specifics of votes in Pima County in the second half of the show. We start with school district bonds and overrides around the state with Nikki Indikavich, Outreach Director for Save Our Schools, Arizona. I started by asking her how Pima County, which passed all of its bonds and overrides, compared to the rest of the state.
Well, the good news is that comparison is pretty accurate. We saw that in a lot of communities here in Arizona around our school bonds and overrides. Pinal County also passed 100% of all of their efforts, which is great. Maricopa is a little bit of a mixed bag, but they did see a very high pass rate, which is typical of Arizona, right? We know that local voters typically do come out and support public schools in these local elections. And so that trend held. And I think it is a signal from voters. They still love public schools and they're not going to budge on that, it appears.
So were there any races that surprised you, either good or bad?
Actually, good surprises for me. I was nervous about a lot of our bonds and overrides. Going into the election, we have seen some pretty dirty tactics from opposition in some of our communities. And I thought there was a chance that might be successful. And it was not largely. If you look at some of the districts where those tactics were deployed, they passed. And I think they might have passed at higher rates because of some of that. Maricopa proper, the interior, Scottsdale, Paradise Valley, Phoenix Union, they look great. You know, their communities are very happy with their school districts and happy to provide additional resources. And if you take a look at what's going on in that community, there is an effort to sell otherwise to voters, right? There's groups saying, we're not happy with these public schools. You know, it really doesn't matter what people say. It's all about what you do. And voters seem to make it clear they love their local schools and they're willing to do more for them.
The largest district in the state, Mesa Unified, was among that handful of cases where a school bond didn't pass, but it was close with, as we're looking at things now on Wednesday afternoon, about 1,000 vote difference. However, we saw the third largest district in the state, Tucson Unified, get a bond passed for the first time in years. Do large districts tend to fare any better or worse in these bond elections?
I don't know what the trend is. I'm sure there's some kind of trend there. My experience has been it kind of depends on turnout. And we may find out that some Mesa voters that were strong public school supporters may have stayed home. And that made a difference in a tight race. Tucson Unified appears to have turned out pretty well down there. The entire county actually turned out pretty high for an off-cycle year here. With not a lot of races on these ballots. And so it may be a turnout issue in Mesa. They may just need to do a better job speaking to those voters and helping them understand how important it is. What we know about voters is they do want to do what's best for public schools, but they don't always know how to get there, right? And they may not have even known that these funding measures were on the ballot. When you see that 50-50, like what we're seeing in Mesa, it's a heartbreaker. But it's also, I think, for that community, an opportunity to say, hey, we've got to talk to more voters. I think you'll see those school districts immediately start reevaluating how they reach community members, because outside of elections, it's vital to have buy-in from your community no matter what.
ABC 15 data reporter Garrett Archer, who those of us who like data know is the data guru, noted that it appears to be mostly large suburban and exurban school districts who have problems passing bonds or overrides. Does any of that have to do with the fact just larger populations, maybe more kids going to private schools or charter schools or things like that? Or is it better reach out is needed in larger districts?
I'm not sure. I mean, it could be a combination, and that's likely what you're seeing in these East Valley races, is you do have a concerted effort to really kind of marginalize our public schools and pick on them a little bit. And you see it more in the East Valley. And the reality is it's based off a lot of stuff that's really not happening. You know, we've seen these board meetings and all of this really poor behavior on the part of some of these groups, saying things that aren't true, accusing teachers of things they don't do, and failing to recognize the quality education that's available to their kids in these communities. And I think the East Valley's seen a lot of that tension. I do hope that now that we're on the other side of this election, the opposition will kind of take a look at what's going to happen to these school districts should they continue this defunding process. Are these schools getting better? Because the reality is that Mesa schools perform very high academically. You will get to a point where parents just simply say, like, enough is enough. This is the school that I chose because it's successful and I want my kids there. Back off, please, on these local elections, and let's get back to this kind of work of taking care of kids. There are a lot of young people that rely on the health of that public school that's been put in jeopardy because of politics, which is the worst reason to put a community in jeopardy, right? If you have concerns about your public school, go and respectfully air that out at a board meeting and have conversations with decision makers. It does not mean that you need to actively work to defund programs that kids need.
Do we see in elections districts with high numbers of retirees or snowbirds that they have more trouble because those voters who tend to be, you know, very often the people who are casting ballots just say, well, I don't have kids in here. What do I care? And vote no.
Yeah, I just moved from Yavapai County a couple of months ago. I ran two bond efforts in Prescott Valley. It's a retiree community. We could not pass either. And that is the reality. If you looked at the returns data on those locals, it was retirees that did not vote to support that local bond effort. And so it really is a matter of those retirees. They need to be looped into what's going on in that public school. And more often than not, if they are looped in, they do support public schools because they understand the value of strong public schools. But the work needs to be done. This is a destination state for retirees. A lot of these retirees don't fully understand Arizona public schools and how we're funded and how important these locals are. And so it is the job of everybody around a public school to bring those retirees in and say, you know, this is what your community needs. This is the benefit of a strong public school. This is how you get there with some of those locals. Long term, though, I think Arizona needs to think about the lawmakers that have put our schools in these positions. The reality is that Arizona's public schools go out for these locals to make up for state deficits. The long-term fix really is to have a conversation about how we fund our public schools.
In Wilcox, in Cochise County, obviously a rural county, we have a vote that right now, again, as of Wednesday afternoon, is passing, but only by 24 votes, and there's still more to be counted. So nobody knows which way this one is necessarily going to go. Do rural districts like the ones in Cochise County have more of a difficult time passing things than the more urban districts?
Oh, absolutely. And that, I will say, Wilcox Unified School District, I'm super excited because they actually went out a couple of years ago and they failed, and their team actively said, you know, we are going to pursue this again because it's what our community needs. So to see them potentially win this would be huge for that school district. But the reality is, if you're in rural Arizona, it is so much more difficult to get a hold of some of your neighbors and have these conversations. For instance, Wilcox Unified School District is super spread out. It's very rural. There's still farmland in that school district. And so to knock doors in Wilcox Unified, that's quite a commitment, and it can be quite difficult terrain. And you see that a lot in our rural communities, right? They're very spread out. Homes are not next to each other. And so the advocates that go out for these local elections, they really are taking on Herculean efforts to contact neighbors that live miles apart.
All of these elections, obviously this year, off year election, everybody's already talking about next year. It's going to be a big year. Does that hurt school districts, or does it help school districts with bonds and overrides to do it in an off year election? Pima County, again, we're still counting, but it had about a 15% turnout, which for an off year might be good, but for overall is not such great turnout.
Well, we'll see. You know, 2024 is coming at us, whether we're ready for it or not. And I do think you are going to see some of these school districts have to look to the 2024 ballot if they didn't pass here. And that's a very different electorate. 15% turnout is good. But the reality is 2024, you're up into the 70s and the 80% turnout. So that electorate is vastly different, for better or for worse. The thing about presidential years is you have a lot of voters that only ever vote presidential. And it's the only reason they go, right? They don't always stick to their down ballot. They don't always stay. And this is going to be a long ballot. And so for school districts looking at 2024, it is going to be all about keeping that voter focused on the bottom of the ballot.
The last thing I have was probably one of the first things I should have asked. So we've heard all about bonds and overrides. What do most school districts use these bonds and overrides for? Is it day-to-day, literally keeping the schoolhouse doors open and the lights on? Or is it big construction projects, buying new materials for classrooms?
Well, it varies. And that's the great thing about bonds and overrides is it's tailored to your community and the needs of those students. So here in my school district, I'm in Litchfield Elementary School District. My kids go to Agua Fria High. They're having conversations about growth. And so they are looking at potentially new buildings. For other areas, they may be having conversations about staffing. Some districts are talking about pulling down their class sizes a little bit. And so you do see that that varied need really gets met by bonds and overrides. I did hear a lot of talk around kind of new builds in some of the areas where you're seeing population growth. Down in Tucson, it's a little bit different. I don't know that their growth as much as they're looking at kind of fixing up some of their older campuses. They've got aging buildings. They need to take care of that. And everyone's talking about retaining teachers. We've got a problem in Arizona. And just as the defunding piece is kind of being pushed down to the communities via our legislature, the conversation around teacher pay is also not being addressed here. And so you do see locals really doing everything they can to retain those high quality educators. And if that means going out for an override that covers those additional staff pay, that's what they're going to do to try to keep educators in our classrooms here in Arizona.
All right. Well, now the waiting game begins for some of the races that are close, like Wilcox. We'll just have to wait and see. Thanks for spending some time chatting with us.
Absolutely. Anytime.
That was Nikki Indakevich, the outreach director for Save Our Schools Arizona. We're looking at the results of this week's off-year elections. Voters in the city of Tucson decided to keep their mayor and three city council candidates in office in Tuesday's election, while people just east of the city opted to remain unincorporated rather than form the town of Vail. To break down the results, we invited in two local journalists, Becky Palak of AZ Luminaria and Kurt Prendergast from the Tucson Agenda. I started by asking for their observations in the race for Tucson's mayor and city council.
I don't think there are any surprises. I think Regina Romero is a popular mayor in Tucson right now, and her first term was really difficult. She had to deal with a pandemic, she had to deal with protests, variety of really difficult issues. So, you know, she came through that fire and voters are giving her a second term as mayor.
Yeah, she mentioned in her speech at her victory party, or the Democratic victory party, that the pandemic was officially declared 100 days, almost exactly at the 100-day mark of the beginning of her term.
I mean, I think another thing with Romero's first term is there isn't really any big scandal to point to, right? There hasn't been, you know, much dirt. So people who agree with her values and the direction of the city, they're going to vote for her. People who disagree aren't going to vote for her. And it's just a numbers game, and more people agree with what she's doing.
2009 was the last time the city of Tucson saw a Republican elected to either mayor or city council, Steve Kozacik, who then became a Democrat. Republicans will make a big deal out of that because of the way the city votes. Is it possible for a Republican to get elected? Because there was a Republican challenger for every city seat this year.
I think that was actually the victory for the party, was that they fielded a complete slate of candidates, and those candidates were out in the city getting their names known. You know, name recognition is really important in these races, so we'll see if any of them decide to try again.
Yeah, I mean, that has been their task, is they're all first-time candidates. They don't have any political experience, so they have to, A, get their name out, B, learn how the game is played, you know, what is good to do as a candidate, what isn't, so all those lessons. They have to learn how to fundraise, build an architecture of a campaign so they can have volunteers out pounding on doors and things like that. And so it is a question of, like, the candidates, the Republican candidates that came out this year. But then there also is the structural thing of the hybrid system, right? So Ward 4, the early ballots were super tight. But then you would never know that if you looked at the final tallies, because all the Democrats in the city, they vote for all these candidates. So the one area where the Republicans had a shot just gets, there's a tsunami of Democratic votes from elsewhere in the city, just wipe it away.
You mentioned, Kurt, before we got going, the interesting symmetry of the votes, though. Almost all the candidates, and Mayor Romero had the closest of the races that we know of at this point on Wednesday afternoon. There are still some votes to be counted. And she still got 60%, but most of the races were 60-something, 30-something. We don't tend to see symmetry like that in elections very often.
Yeah, I mean, that jumped out at me when I saw it. It was just 60-something to 30-something. The 2-to-1 voter registration the advantage that Democrats have, it just completely played out in the tally of the votes. It did not look like there are many people. Again, it's Wednesday. You know, any late votes and stuff like that, we'll see later. But it did not look like a lot of Democrats went to the Republican candidate or Republican candidates went to the Democrat. It just looked like a very party line vote.
Ed Ackerley running again for mayor as an independent. I heard chatter from some Republicans early on that maybe the Republicans should just get behind Ed as an independent and not field a candidate. They did. In the end, he didn't do very well, which to me was a little surprising. I thought he would have gotten more votes than he did.
He said heading into this race that this was going to be his last go for this office. So, you know, he's run twice now. I don't think he's planning to run again. I think he was counting on some disgruntled Democrats to go and vote for him. And it doesn't look like that happened.
Well, one thing is Wittenbraker and Ackerley, when I was watching the candidate forums, it was hard to tell the difference between the two. They were both very much like, we need more police, and they just had similar solutions to the same problems. So I thought that it would be difficult for people to decide, you know, which way to go, Ackerley or Wittenbraker. But Wittenbraker just did so much better than Ackerley. And it could be, I don't know, this is obviously just me speculating, but it could be that people sized up Ackerley in 2019 and they were like, yeah, we like him, we don't like him. And then Wittenbraker comes on the scene and she has more energy and she just has a different, you know, vibe than Ackerley does. And they went with Wittenbraker. She was the new person.
She also got the endorsement from Carrie Lake, mm-hmm. Which certainly puts her strongly in the Republican camp.
Ackerley also had a strategy this year where he was focused on winning votes on the South side. And so it'll be really interesting to see in the official results later what the turnout was like on the South side, because he was counting on people to send in those ballots.
Again, we're still early in the counting process. It's Arizona. It takes us a while, but that's fine. Anything with turnout that either of you saw? It was, the last time I looked at it, almost 16%, which is nothing to write home about, especially coming into a presidential year next year. Anything strike you on voter turnout?
It wasn't too far off of the voter turnout in the last city council races in 2019. So I think we're just seeing Tucson's core voters, you know, dedicated party voters voting in this election.
I think that one of the races, at least a lot of us in the media were watching within the newsrooms, was Prop 413, the raise for the mayor and council. It's been defeated so many times, including the year that Tucson voters approved an increase in the minimum wage that ended up putting city council members making less than minimum wage because it wasn't approved. Right now, it's passing very close, too close to call. And again, it's only Wednesday afternoon. But I think a lot of people were surprised that it was even close.
I was surprised when I saw that. I didn't know what to expect, but I thought it was going to go one way or the other. To have it be this tight was interesting. But then it's also the 2021 version of Prop 413, right? That salary increase, that was super tight as well. And it was a similar situation where we didn't know what it was going to be until a day or two afterwards. In retrospect, it shouldn't be surprising that this happened, but I kind of had the visceral reaction to the dollar amount, you know, that it was so much. And I was thinking that a lot of voters would be repulsed by that. Turns out it's just half and half. Some people want it, some people don't.
I think it was a confusing question. We saw a lot of undervotes on this question. It was about 30% of people who voted just didn't answer yes or no on Prop 413. I think that the idea that the mayor and council salaries are now tied to the Pima County Board of Supervisors salaries, which are set by the state legislature, was confusing for a lot of people. They weren't sure if we were giving away our local power to the county or the state. So just the way that the proposition was worded and the questions that people had, I think some people just decided to skip the question.
The kind of public conversation about this leading up to the vote, a big thing was, why didn't they put the dollar value in there? You would have to look up the Pima County Board of Supervisors salary in order to know what you're voting. I went into the archives of the Salary Commission and I wrote about that, and it was very interesting that they, earlier this year, they met and they had long conversations about how to phrase this thing. I think that took up more than almost any other topic that they discussed. And in the end, they basically were like, what we've drafted is so complicated that people aren't going to understand it. They're going to think that we're doing something deceptive. So we want to keep this as simple as possible. Then they had the 11th hour proposal to just tie it to the supervisors. And that seemed like a simple, elegant solution to them. But you can't escape the fact that you don't have a lot of space to write this stuff. Right. So you have to have, there's some words you got to have in there. And so they ended up tying it to the supervisors. I do think that voters, if they don't immediately understand what this proposition means, they are going to feel like you're trying to pull a quick one. So I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people were just like you pointed out, right? They're like, I'm just going to move on. I'm not going to deal with this one.
And I know when we talked to the various candidates, Paul Cunningham, Lane Santa Cruz, and we asked them what they thought about it, they all kind of backed away from it and said, I'm not really going to talk about this because it does affect them directly. So they were in a little bit of a bind on talking about it.
I think they're not supposed to take an official position, so they're being cautious. But I think a yes vote on this proposition meant that some voters are ready to see these be real full-time leadership positions in the city. Right now, some council members are doing these jobs full-time, and others work a regular job on and they're a council person on the side. And
like, so, Paul Cunningham, he's a teacher.
That's right. And I think this is a signal from voters that they're ready to pay these leaders like they're leaders.
And I think it's also worth noting that the different iterations of the Salary Commission over the years have tried like virtually everything. They've, you know, just name a dollar amount and they probably have put that up on the ballot at one point or the other. I wonder how many voters were just like, let's just be done with this, you know?
True. And if not, we'll probably see it in 2 years yet again.
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, if it passes this year, and then all of a sudden people are going to see, like, you know, the mayor is going to be making 100 grand, 96,000, and 121,000. And that is just going to be all over every criticism of the mayor. You know, what are we paying you for? You know, so I wouldn't be surprised that even if it passes this year, 2 years from now, there's going to be we're going to have the Salary Commission again. It'll be a whole other debate.
Or potentially we're paying the mayor this much. In this case, Mayor Romero, why isn't she doing it? Someone will try a recall because now we're paying her all this money. And who knows? Yeah, more pressure comes with more money, I guess. At the Democratic Victory Party, Paul Cunningham took his time at the podium and really was trying to rally the Democratic troops. He said his thank yous, obligatory thank yous and all of that, but then pivoted right to 24. We need to take back LD 17 and Democrats need to take back Congress, the seat currently held by Congressman Ciscomani, and the Senate. We need to hold that, and the White House and all that. Okay, some of us, like you all and me, who watch these things, we're not ready for 24, but it's here. You care to get out your crystal ball and make some predictions for Southern Arizona on 24?
One thing that I'll be paying attention to in the 2024 election is the effect of independence. So people are leaving parties. They don't want to be registered Republican or registered Democrat. So how is our purple state going to react to all the party money that's going to flood in? The political parties don't want voters to be purple. They want you to pick a side, red or blue, and they're going to spend a lot of money to influence your votes on that.
And one thing I'm curious about is once we get the detailed data on this election that we just had, how does a candidate, so like Wittenbraker, you know, celebrated being endorsed by Carrie Lake, right? So how did that play with Republicans? You know, she certainly, if you bring up the independent side of it, I guess independent candidate, Ackerley did so much, he did so much worse than Wittenbraker, and Wittenbraker had the seal of Carrie Lake and Abe Hamadeh in that crowd. So as of today, we had 24,000 people voted for Wittenbraker in Tucson. So this is a super blue place, right? So I'm very curious what lessons like I can draw from this, and like the political observers and operatives are going to draw from this, how well she did with the seal of a Carrie Lake type person in a blue area like this. What does that portend for other races in similar areas?
Especially when you get out into Pima County, which is more red than blue city of Tucson. So.
Mm-hmm. Those political analysts will definitely be looking at the precinct level results this city election for those kinds of insights.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And then we get out into the other counties and mm-hmm. off we go.
Yeah, so with the 2024s, we're going to have Sisquamani, we're going to have Grijalva, we'll have the presidential. What else
have
we got?
U.S. Senate.
U.S. Senate, right? So U.S. Senate's going to be Carrie Lake versus Gallego.
With Sinema. Potentially, we don't know. She hasn't officially said anything one way or another.
Mm-hmm. And we'll have Engel versus Sisquamani, right, down here. And then someone's going to challenge Grijalva. So the Grijalva race, it could end up being very similar to the Romero race, you know, where he just wipes the floor with somebody.
He usually does, but this is a different district now that mm-hmm. runs into Cochise County, though it runs the border, which is more blue than red. They gave that to Sisquamani. Yeah, mm-hmm. it's going to be 2024. The three of us will be busy, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Get ready.
Looking forward to it.
All right. Well, thanks for spending some time.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
That was the Tucson Agenda's Kurt Prendergast and AZ Luminaria's Becky Palak. And that's The Buzz for this week. You can find all our episodes online at azpm.org and subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. Just search for The Buzz Arizona. We're also on the NPR app. Zach Ziegler is our producer with production help from Desiree Tucker. Our music is by Enter the Haggis. I'm Christopher Conover. Thanks for listening.
Arizona Public Media's original programming is made possible in part by the Community Service Grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.